From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Last week, congressional Democrats unveiled a pretty ambitious proposal to reframe the country's debate on climate change. Billed as the Green New Deal, its name obviously evokes FDR's signature response to the Great Depression. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez characterized the measure as an urgent imperative.
We need to save ourselves, and we can save the rest of the world with us. That is why we should do it. And that's why we define the scope of this resolution to be so broad and to be so comprehensive.
It's more of an aspirational statement than a concrete plan, giving a sense of direction. And what you didn't hear or read are the words nuclear energy. There are plenty of fears about nuclear power, and for good reason. But can you tackle climate change without it? This hour On Point, the debate over nuclear power's role in a clean energy future. Join us. What are your thoughts about nuclear energy? Replacing it could make it even tougher to get to zero carbon emissions. Keeping it? Nuclear plants carry grave risks, and generating energy by splitting uranium atoms is far more expensive than tapping natural gas. So, given all that, should zero emissions nuclear power be a part of U.S. energy policy? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. With us for the moment, from Washington, is Lisa Friedman. She's a reporter for the New York Times focusing on climate and environmental policy. She's also been covering the Green New Deal. Lisa, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So Lisa, set the stage for a minute or two, putting aside for the moment nuclear power and also putting aside some of the other ambitions, the expansion of the social welfare net and other things attached to it. What is it that the Green New Deal seeks to do when it comes to addressing climate change?
Really avert the worst consequences of climate change by enacting a massive infrastructure and overhaul of United States energy development. What it calls for is incredibly broad. And I would note, just as a caveat, and this is going to be important when it comes to the discussion we'll have shortly on nuclear power, that the way it was described in the days leading up to the resolution that was actually released last week and what is actually contained in the resolution are a little bit different.
And we can get to that in a sec, but let's talk about what it is claiming to do now.
So the resolution itself calls for a massive government mobilization toward getting to 100% renewable and clean power by 2030, retrofitting and upgrading all buildings in the United States to meet energy efficiency standards, overhauling the nation's transportation system to boost EV and electric vehicles and high-speed rail, working with farmers to reduce methane emissions the list goes on. I mean, on every part of society, enhancing the resiliency of structures throughout the country to protect them against sea level rise and other impacts of climate change. It is a sweeping, all-encompassing, breathtakingly ambitious call to action on climate change in an effort to meet what scientists say is needed. The United Nations scientists last year came out with a report and, essentially said that the world needs to make major changes in quite a short time and needs to reach net zero carbon neutrality globally by 2050 to avert the worst consequences of climate change.
That's right. So not only accomplish what's needed technologically, but also accomplish it on the timeline that's needed to actually have an ameliorative effect to ease this stuff. Now let's take the nuclear question. There were some supporting memos that circulated that did talk a little bit about nuclear power. But what role does nuclear power play, if any, in this plan? And then what seemingly was some of the thinking behind it, at least in the earlier days?
Sure. In the plan itself, it is not mentioned. We should note that natural gas is not mentioned, biofuels are not mentioned, carbon capture and storage technology is not mentioned. The resolution itself is purposefully technology neutral. And Senator Ed Markey, one of the sponsors of the legislation, said that they designed it that way in order to encourage support from you know, members of Congress across the spectrum. An earlier iteration of the resolution called for 100% renewable energy by 2030, which would exclude nuclear. That was softened, and so there's no clear or explicit refusal of nuclear, nor is it proactively embraced. A fact sheet, you know, there was a you know, for those who follow the Green New Deal, you know, they'll know that there was a very flubbed unveiling
FAQ,
of
right?
The Green New Deal. Right, there was an FAQ, a fact sheet on Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's homepage that initially said that the Green New Deal, which they described as a massive investment in renewable energy production, would not include creating new nuclear plants. It went on to say it's unclear if we will be able to decommission every nuclear plant within 10 years, but the plan is to transition off of nuclear and all fossil fuels as soon as possible.
And then to meet with Markey's desire, it was removed in part to remain agnostic to get a big tent, right?
Exactly.
And very, very briefly, Elisa, before we let you go on this busy day, you know, in the worlds in which you circulate, when people talk about coverage and think about hard about the science involved, do people entertain the idea of doing this without nuclear power?
The energy experts that we've spoken to say that it is incredibly difficult. I mean, you know, my colleague Tripp Gabriel and I have a story coming out in the next few days looking at what it will take to meet the goals in the Green New Deal. And now you look at the power goal alone. 37% of U.S. electricity right now comes from zero carbon sources. 20% of that is nuclear. Bloomberg New Energy Finance, which focuses on, you know, the energy transition and is a huge proponent of renewable energy, but they're very optimistic that renewables will become the lowest cost option in the near future. They, however, see, with no new policies, a rise to about 44% clean energy by 2030, as long as no nuclear plants are closed or retired. You know, and so it's very hard to get there. I think that's why you see folks like Sheldon Whitehouse, who is one of the Senate's, you know, biggest proponents of tackling climate change.
He's on board with keeping nuclear with that, right?
Absolutely. I mean,
Let me do this, Lisa.
Has to be part of the portfolio. Yes.
Well, and thank you for this. Lisa Friedman, New York Times, thank you for setting the table for us on this tough and contentious issue. We appreciate it so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
We're going to hear this hour from two people who have, in a sense, traded places on what they think. First, I'd like to welcome Gregory Yatsko. He served on the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission and then as its chairman from 2009 to 2012. His new book is Confessions of a Rogue Nuclear Regulator. Welcome, Greg.
Hi, David. It's really a pleasure to be with you.
So we're going to talk a little bit about your career and your path into your conclusion on this. But briefly, we've got several minutes before the end of this first segment. Why can't nuclear power play a constructive role in getting us to a carbon-free or a carbon-greatly diminished future?
Well, I think the biggest challenge is really just the ability – well, let's take the United States as the best example – the inability to build new reactors. We have a number of reactors, about 100 reactors in the country today, and those reactors are eventually going to have to shut down. They will run out of their useful life. And to maintain that minimal percentage of nuclear power, we would have to build basically 100 plants. We can barely build two plants right now over the course of about 15 years. So that's the fundamental problem, is nobody in this country really knows how today to build at scale nuclear reactors. And to build them in the way that we really need, not only to add to really the existing capacity, but just to replace the existing capacity. So that to me is just that's the first place you just have to stop and say, okay, well, how can we do it? And it's just something that's really not being done right now.
You know, Senator Cory Booker is one of several Democratic presidential candidates who's embraced the Green New Deal, and he's also promoting nuclear energy, as he did in 2016 at the Advanced Nuclear Summit, in which he emphasized the importance of investing in both renewable and nuclear power.
The original proposals that we put forward had not just wind and solar, but also had nuclear energy. We have to be a country that steps up and says it has to be renewable, new advanced nuclear energy.
Now, Greg Yatsko, you know, we've had so many advances in so many elements of American life. Surely American nuclear technology has improved over the years.
Well, you'd think that. And, you know, I guess this is one of those situations where I'm in a, you know, fool me once, shame on me, fool me twice, or fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. I've been around the nuclear industry for a long time, and I've heard the promises. When I started out in this business, the future was going to be so-called pebble bed reactors, which became popular and got a lot of attention from Congress, and a lot of experts on the Hill talked about how we were going to power the future with pebble bed reactors and hydrogen generation and hydrogen cars. Well, that went by the wayside. We then had the so-called nuclear renaissance, which I lived through at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, where we were going to build up to 30 reactors, which sounds like a large number, but would have been about a third of the existing reactor fleet, so hardly making a big dent in our carbon emissions. That has turned into four plants, which were licensed when I was at the NRC, which two have been canceled after spending $10 billion, and another two which are continuing to be constructed with an indefinite operation period and with a price tag of $27.5 billion. So there's also the small modular reactor boom, which I lived through as well. And so, you know, I could go on and on and on about the promises that have failed to.
But you're saying promises made, promises lapsed. We're discussing nuclear power in America and its place in the nation's clean energy future. We'll be back with Greg Yatsko and with someone who from the opposing side. You can join our conversation and our debate. What questions do you have about the practicality, safety, and promise of nuclear energy in America? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're looking at nuclear power's possible role in a clean energy future. You can join our conversation. Do you see a role for it? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. With me now is Greg Yatsko. He served as chairman of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission from 2009 to 2012. His new book is Confessions of a Rogue Nuclear Regulator. I want to first take a couple of quick calls to help us propel this conversation. Nate's calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Nate, what do you think?
Hi, and thank you for having me. I'm, first of all, just glad that they're talking about trying to deal more with global warming because we need to. It's an important issue for the U.S. and the rest of the planet. And I'm actually kind of neutral when it comes to if nuclear is part of it or not. But if it is, what about the possibility of using breeder reactors? My loose understanding is they have vastly smaller nuclear waste problems afterwards, and we could potentially even recycle some of the nuclear waste we already have. This might involve modifying international treaties, but when people are violating treaties already, that shouldn't be too difficult, perhaps.
Okay. Well, thanks for that, Nate. We'll come back to that issue in a little bit down the line. I also want to take a call from Springfield, Massachusetts. Tim, what do you think? Good idea to proceed using nuclear power? Should we build it up?
Well, I think that having been following the nation's nuclear arsenal and our power plants across the country as much as a layman can, our nuclear power plants and our weapons are in a very poor state of readiness. If you work at a missile silo, you're underpaid, you live in a remote location, there's nothing to do, you know, no good schools. If you work in a nuclear power plant, people are cutting corners. They're not following protocol. Tanks go missing. Cracks go unreported. Or when they are reported, they're, you know, they fall to the bottom of the paperwork pile. I think while we do have the technical expertise, when it comes time to actually getting people to do their job properly, the effort's just not there.
Well, Tim, let me tell you, we got just the guy to address that, and thank you for raising that concern. Greg Yatsko, you were the head of the chief agency that regulates nuclear power in this country, right? Obviously, there's some joint things with the U.S. Energy Department, but nonetheless, you're head of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. You start out, as you talk about in your book, Confessions of a Rogue Nuclear Regulator, you start out like you're a physicist. You got a PhD. You think about these things from a scientific point of view as well as a policy point of view, and you're kind of, you know, mildly okay with it. You seem, you know, agnostically supportive, I guess, in a weird contradictory sense of nuclear power. And then you make a real evolution in your thinking over time. How did that come about?
Yeah, you know, I really started looking at this issue just kind of as a technical person, as a scientist, and then I got involved in the regulatory business and became a regulator. And that's when I really started to see a very heavy political policy influence on the technology. And it shapes how you think about the technology. It shapes how you deal with safety, which is extremely important for nuclear power. And it really came to a culmination when I was witnessing in real time the Fukushima nuclear accident in Japan, which had significant consequences. It led to the evacuation of about 100,000 people, many of whom can't go back to their homes. It was a catastrophe that caused carbon emissions in Japan to rise because in the aftermath of the accident, all of the nuclear power plants in Japan were shut down. It was an accident that caused a significant impact to the overall economy of Japan. So once I saw that, I realized that these accidents aren't really hypothetical, you know, scenarios that you can dream up in your computer simulations, but that they're real things that happen and can have real impacts on people. And to me, that wasn't something that should be coming from the sources of electricity. It's those are the kinds of things you expect from, you know, just from natural disasters and from wars, from these kinds of global or national scale crises. It wasn't something that you would expect or should expect from your electricity generation.
In 2011, then President Obama addressed the nation following the Fukushima nuclear power plant disaster in Japan and said that he had requested a review of American nuclear power plants and their safety in the wake of that catastrophe.
When we see a crisis like the one in Japan, we have a responsibility to learn from this event and to draw from those lessons to ensure the safety and security of our people. That's why I've asked the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to do a comprehensive review of the safety of our domestic nuclear plants in light of the natural disaster that unfolded in Japan.
It was a deadly incident. You describe, Greg Yatsko, in your book, putting on this incredibly intensive, like, white robes and protective gear to go and sort of look at the site after the fact with some of your Japanese counterparts. When you looked at that system, you know, there was an earthquake, there was a tsunami, there were some mistakes made. Did you think there were specific mistakes to this, or did you conclude this is beyond our capacity to address?
Yeah, I mean, in hindsight, you see clearly what the mistakes were. That plant was built too close to the coast. It was built in an area where significant tsunamis had, in fact, happened in the past, and we didn't, or the Japanese didn't properly identify that. So, you know, there were a number of mistakes, but that's always the way these accidents will be. There are always a number of mistakes that in hindsight seem obvious. And what I began to realize as you look at this technology more and more is that there's always going to be a way for all the redundancies and all the backup systems that are there to keep a plant safe. There's always going to be a way for those to fail. And it's simply a question of when and where that will happen. So One of the things that I really thought about is that we have to become much more comfortable with the idea of nuclear accidents, that if we're going to have this technology, we can't continue to try and promote it as a technology that is safe, but that as a technology that we try and maintain safely, but will invariably have periodically these kinds of accidents. Some of them will be significant, like Fukushima, where they release a lot of radiation to the environment. Other of them will be similar to, say, Three Mile Island, where you destroyed the reactor, but there was only a limited release of radiation. And, you know, either one of which are very, very problematic for a global energy program or electricity program that relies heavily on nuclear power. So, you know, if that's really the future, if that's what people want, then we need to get comfortable with accidents happening every 6 months, every year, something like that, and happening all over the world. So
every
that's
year.
Really the reality. Certainly, yeah. If you talk about scaling up in the way that people would talk about for climate change, you're talking about dramatically increasing the amount of nuclear power plants you have in the world. It's less than 20% of the electricity production in the world right now. It's about 20% in the U.S., but globally, it's much lower than that. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to scale up, you're talking about thousands and thousands of plants worldwide, and there will be accidents on a much more frequent basis.
In 2017, during an appearance on Fox Business News, the Fox Business Network, Energy Secretary Rick Perry explained that over the next 5 to 10 years, the emergence of more cutting-edge nuclear technology will offer improved safety and also be more cost-effective than larger nuclear plants.
I think we'll see a transition away from really big nuclear plants like we've tried to build and have built in the past, partly because of the cost drivers, to these smaller type of reactors that may have substantially more nimble ways to be inserted into the marketplace from a security standpoint, particularly from a cost standpoint.
You might have expected in years past that the environmental activist Michael Schellenberger would be a person who would oppose Energy Secretary Rick Perry. Joining us now from Berkeley, California. Michael is the president of Environmental Progress. It's a research and policy organization that, among other things, advocates for the broader adoption of nuclear power. Michael, so glad to have you with us. Welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, David.
So make the case, Michael. You've just heard from somebody who's been in the room where it happens, right, and has seen some of the terrible consequences and is offering a kind of Cassandra's warning. Why is he wrong? Why do we need to rely upon, extend the life of, perhaps invest more in nuclear power plants in this country as part of our way of addressing going to a zero carbon's future?
Sure. Well, like a lot of people, I was against nuclear power. In fact, I helped stop a proposed radioactive waste repository in California about 20 years ago. And I was actually co-founder of the original Green New Deal in the early 2000s, which was adopted by President Obama, included a huge amount of money for renewables and efficiency. And I only came to change my mind about nuclear when it became clear that you can't power a major economy on solar and wind. And if you want to look for kind of real-world case studies, there's no better examples than France and Germany. France is one of the only countries in the world that has fully decarbonized its electricity supply. Sweden is the other country. Those two countries did so mostly with nuclear, some hydro. And today, France has some of the cheapest electricity in Europe. And if you contrast that to Germany, which has been phasing out nuclear plants, scaling up solar and wind, Germany will have spent $580 billion on its renewables transition by 2025, and its emissions have been flat since 2009. The carbon intensity of Germany's electricity supply is 10 times as high as France's. And if they had spent the $580 billion on nuclear, they would already be getting 100% of the electricity from clean energy sources. So, you know, one of the things that convinced me, it always seems strange, but was I actually went and read the United Nations reports on Chernobyl, which is something that occurred when I was a boy and was very scary. And I was shocked by how little harm there was to public health. I think it's important to put this in context. According to the World Health Organization, 4 million people die every year from air pollution from fossil fuel combustion. About 3 million die from burning biofuels. At Chernobyl, the best estimates from the United Nations is that over a 60 or 80-year period, maybe somewhere around 200 people will die. At Fukushima, there's the number of people that have died from the radiation is somewhere between 0 and 1. depending on who you believe. Meanwhile, I mean, 15,000 people died instantly from a tsunami. You know, it was like one of the worst. These are like you're looking at like these accidents, which are really bad industrial accidents. The entire reactors are melting. Some amount of radiation is escaping. And what's so striking is just how little harm is caused. And that's just partly because trace amounts of radiation just don't cause as much harm as you would think. We're exposed to radiation all the time. You know, there's a new article out by the BBC today that I encourage people to read. It's about Chernobyl. And they're sitting there right next to the plant, the Chernobyl plant, and they're getting one third as much radiation as they got on the flight from London to Kiev. So I just think, you know, I thought it was interesting.
And that is 33, Michael, that is 33 years later, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, look, Fukushima, after the accident, the radiation levels in Fukushima, and I've been there twice, in the soils around Fukushima, the radiation levels were half as high as they are in my home state of Colorado. Why? Because we have a lot of uranium in the granite in my home state. And everyone freaked out in Japan. They wanted it to get to those super low levels, but the levels were just very low. I mean, I think you had a caller who called earlier just now who mentioned who started talking about the nuclear arsenal, and he kept talking about nuclear weapons and nuclear power plants. Psychologists in the 1970s, there have been many studies since, they found that basically what happened is that people who were really terrified of nuclear weapons, like all of us were who grew up in the end of the Cold War, we ended up displacing our anxieties onto nuclear power plants. It became clear you couldn't get rid of nuclear weapons for a variety of reasons. So a lot of activists in the 60s and 70s redirected our anxieties onto nuclear power plants. It just was a lot easier to fearmonger in the ways that Mr. Jasko does about nuclear. It gets people all kind of in their minds. That's all sort of the same thing. And so we have basically been taking out our anxieties on this incredibly benign technology that, according to the climate scientist James Hansen, has actually saved something like 2 million lives just by preventing the air pollution that kills 4 million people a year. You know, I mean, this we have a kind of childlike view of
safety
here.
Michael, let's let Greg pop in here. Greg Yatsko, what do you make of that argument? There haven't been mass deaths as a result of this. Chernobyl, a little more than three decades ago, was terrifying and was deadly. And yet it seemed like a lot of the damage was from the failure to contain, I think, cows that had, radiation contaminated milk. Is this in a world where we do have to manage risk rather than eliminate it entirely? Is this not a reasonable way to go when confronted by the seemingly apocalyptic and existential threat of massive climate change if we don't get carbon emissions under control?
Well, I mean, there's a lot to unpack in what Mr. Schellenberger said, and I would be hard-pressed to find myself as somebody who's a fearmonger. I think that's the kind of labeling that really takes the debate away from the facts. I mean, you know, we started with a discussion about France and Germany, and I think there's a lot of statistics
sure.
that are quoted.
We have a couple minutes left before the end of this segment. So why don't you address a couple of the key things you think?
Well, I mean, let's talk about Chernobyl. Chernobyl was a very, very significant incident and many people harmed. I happened to actually have a lunch with the head of the Ukrainian nuclear regulator at the time when some of those studies from the WHO came out, and she was apoplectic is probably the best way to describe it, because this is the country now, of course, where the reactor is. Their estimates and understanding for the consequences of the Chernobyl accident are much, much different. And, there's no way you can argue that this was not an impactful event. But part of this you have to keep in mind is that we have an emergency evacuation system and an emergency response system around nuclear power plants, which is designed to ensure that in the event of an accident, people are moved away so that their radiation exposures are minimized. But even beyond that, you just take the Fukushima accident. I mean, those assets are destroyed. You destroyed four nuclear power plants. And if we're talking about really trying to scale up quickly and globally any kind of electricity program, you cannot break your reactors. In this country, we have three utilities or three reactors that were broken to the tune of billions of dollars. Those plants had to be shut down because the replacement costs just of fixing those repairs were so much higher than alternative technologies that they shut them down. So it's not fear-mongering that's driving this. It's the performance and the execution of the industry. I mean, you just need to look to NEI, which is the Nuclear Trade Organization, and they do surveys every year. And what they'll find is that the people who live around nuclear power plants, They are extremely supportive. It's something like 85% of the people around nuclear power plants like their nuclear power plants. So you can't say that it's fear that's driving this. It is performance of the industry that is driving the future of the industry.
And let's pause right there. As you can hear, we're discussing and debating the past and the future of nuclear energy in America and the role it plays in our constructing perhaps a more green energy policy. You can join our conversation. What are your thoughts about nuclear power? How would you strike a balance between environmental benefits and safety concerns? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm NPR's media correspondent, David Folkenflik. We're discussing nuclear power in America and its place in the nation's clean energy future. Democrats have put a new Green Deal on the table, but it does not mention nuclear power. We're more than mentioning it, we're putting it right at front and center of our conversation and our debate today. Are you willing for the government to further subsidize nuclear energy? Or would you rather steer investment and research dollars toward renewable power sources such as wind and solar, even if that means relying on carbon-based fuels like natural gas in the meantime? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm joined today by two guests. There's Greg Yatsko. He's former chairman of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, author of the new book, Confessions of a Rogue Nuclear Regulator. And you can find an excerpt of his book at our website, onpointradio.org. We also have with us from Berkeley, California, Michael Schellenberger, a longtime environmental activist, as well as president of Environmental Progress, an independent research organization that supports nuclear energy development. Michael, when you started making this transition and speaking out about the need to embrace nuclear power toward a carbon-free future, how is that received in the environmental community?
Highly mixed. I was partly inspired by the Stuart Brand, who was the co-founder of the Whole Earth Catalog. He came out as pro-nuclear in 2005, got a lot of us thinking. I spent basically 5 years between 2005 2010 getting comfortable with the idea. A big part of it was just the social issue. You know, when all your friends and family and colleagues, you know, are anti-nuclear, you hesitate. I think like ultimately facts still matter. And I think that there's a kind of a weird view that sort of things should be 100% safe. I mean, we all drive in our cars to get around the world. You know, 17,000 people die a year from cars in the United States. If you're really concerned about safety, you would want nuclear because it doesn't produce deadly air pollution. So for me, it was always like, you can sort of just be cowed by the fear-mongering, or you can just kind of go, look, this is just something that humans are – it's going to take some time. It's a radically new technology, amazing technology, because it creates heat and energy without creating fire and smoke. And humans are, you know, used to – we evolved with fire. But I think over time, the truth wins out. People were scared of vaccines for a very long time and still are in some cases. But I do think eventually, you know, we'll come around to seeing the technology for what it really is.
You know, I grew up in Orange County, California, maybe, 15, 20 miles from San Onofre, a nuclear power plant, which I believe is now shut down off San Clemente. It always loomed there as a concern. There was the movie when I was 10, the China syndrome, and then, of course, the Three Mile Island concern. And it seemed as though what happened in Fukushima less than a decade ago in Japan was going to trigger concerns like that. The day after the earthquake that caused the crisis there, Joseph Cirincione, was president of the Plowshares Fund, an organization against the spread of nuclear weapons, spoke on CNN about why he felt the situation was so severe.
Well, this is an extremely dangerous situation. You can't get too close to us. Many of the systems that are meant to control the reactors have collapsed. There is no coolant system anymore, so they continue to have to pump water in. The scientist over at Nature magazine just today on an online report said that it's going to take decades, maybe a century, to clean up after this mess.
Greg Yatsko, you were head of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission at the time. You consulted with your Japanese colleagues. You tried to give guidance to them, give guidance to American policymakers. I think at one point in front of Congress, you may have overstated certain risks a little bit. But, you know, it's hard and fluid to try to figure out what's going on. What we just heard was pretty dire in that clip there from the day after the earthquake. How much have those fears been brought to fruition?
Well, I mean, you know, at the time of the accident, it was very severe, and it is, you know, the situation is what it is. It's a, you have four damaged reactors, you have a significant area of contamination, you have a cleanup that's estimated now by the Japanese government to be about $200 billion, or the net impact to the economy of the accident. So it is a very significant accident. But I think, you know, what I hear from Mr. Schellenberger is this idea that it's just this irrational fear that's driving decision making. I mean, I can tell you pretty directly after the accident, there was concern in this country, but the general policy consensus was to move forward. And the general consensus at the NRC was to move forward. Not a single reactor in this country shut down as a result of the Fukushima accident. And what I was doing around the time of the accident was reassuring people of the oversight system that we had in place at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And in fact, less than a year after that accident, we licensed the first of the new reactors to be licensed in decades in the United States. So, you know, the I think it's a useful trope to somehow try and say that there's just this fear that's kept us from progressing with nuclear power, but the facts simply just don't bear it out. And unfortunately, you look at what's happened with those reactors today, and I think, as I mentioned earlier in the show, there were four reactors that were licensed. Two of them have been canceled, and they were canceled because the projects were significantly over budget. They had indefinite completion dates, and they bankrupt the construction company that was building them. So, you know, those are the facts that are driving the policymaking and the decision making right now with nuclear, which is why it's problematic in my mind to foresee a future in this country where we're somehow going to do massive scaling up of nuclear construction. It's just they had a shot. That shot they knew at the time that if they didn't get it right, that would essentially end a future nuclear build program in this country. And that's what we're seeing.
David, can I say something about that?
Yes. Take a moment.
Very briefly. I mean, so the fact that fear of nuclear energy causes more harm than the radiation that escapes from the accidents is well established in the scientific literature. If you go read the United Nations reports on Chernobyl and Fukushima, the scientists are very clear about that. 2,000 people died from the panicked, unnecessary over-evacuation of Fukushima, which Mr. Jasko acknowledges his role in contributing to by misstating against his own staff what the situation of the fuel
that,
pools
David,
were in
can
Japan.
I just interrupt?
Can I finish,
inaccurate.
Actually? I didn't interrupt you.
Tell you what. Guys.
But
Greg, let me make sure that you get a chance to rebut that, Greg.
Yeah,
Michael, finish your thought on this.
Yeah.
And I'm most interested in the policy, but go ahead.
Look, I mean, people should go read the United Nations reports yourself. You'll find that in the Chernobyl, the Fukushima reports, they'll say that it was fear of nuclear and the panics that subsequently followed them that were far more harmful than any radiation that escaped. Mr. Jasko keeps saying that nuclear is more expensive in the United States. It's more expensive than coal and natural gas. It's not more expensive than solar and wind. I know Mr. Jasko is now a wind energy developer who has a financial interest in the wind industry. But it's just look at France and Germany. All you need to know is that Germany spends twice as much on its electricity. Its carbon intensity of its electricity supply is 10 times higher than France's. Nuclear saves lives. Anti-nuclear fear-mongering actually creates serious and significant harm, and it's very well established in the scientific literature.
Now, I want to give Greg Yatsko the chance to respond. I note that the radiation protective gloves are off, and I want to encourage us to focus on the issues here as well as fair to look at the public record here. But Greg, go ahead. You wanted to say correct the record you felt.
Well, yeah. I mean, first of all, the U.S. did not order any evacuations in Japan. Those were evacuation orders issued by the Japanese. The U.S. government made travel advisories to American citizens in Japan. Those travel advisories were recommended by my agency, by me, based on the assessment and the analysis of the technical experts within the agency. Now, you can actually go through and read. It was one of these quirks of history that all of that was actually recorded. And around the time of the accident, when I made the recommendation involved Americans staying 50 miles away from the accident, that was all recorded in the discussions about the technical staff believing that that was the appropriate recommendation. And I questioned them multiple times and asked them if it was the right thing. And they said, yeah, we think this is what we would do if this is what was happening in the U.S. So, you know, this was not some, you know, that was not where I was going rogue.
I'm talking about the spent fuel pools. I'm talking about the spent, when you claimed that the fuel pools were empty. You acknowledged in your book that you got that wrong, and it was
correct.
That was based,
so let me answer, Michael.
That was based on an assessment from the technical staff of the agency, and moreover, it was not the sole basis for the evacuation or for the recommended 50-mile decision that we made. So it was a contributing factor, and we were right to be concerned about the spent fuel pools. And unfortunately, at the time, the Japanese government was not able to give us more conclusive information about what was going on, but they had strong concerns and beliefs. You know, as I talk about in the book, I happened to meet with a counterpart in Japan when I was there 2 weeks after the accident, and he was projecting scenarios that were even worse, where you had more spent fuel pools with potentially loss of water and significant releases. So it was something we were wrong about, but it was certainly not the primary basis for the decisions that we made. And moreover, it was based on the advice and recommendations of the technical staff of the agency. And these are not people who I think anyone would characterize as prone to fear-mongering or irrational decision-making.
Actually,
okay, gentlemen, I just want to make sure that we can get a couple callers in before we close out. We have some minutes left, but we want to get to them. It's part of the show. I want to hear from Amali, who's calling from Macon, Georgia, and then we'll take one or two more calls. Molly, go ahead.
Hi. 3 Mile Island, Chernobyl, Fukushima, 3 enormous strikes against nuclear energy and a host of others that we don't know about, not to mention transporting depleted plutonium across the country on trains. And in Georgia, we're building on the coast, great idea, being facetious, a nuclear power plant. It's enormously over budget, and the customers of the Southern Company, which is the big electric utility in Georgia, we're having to subsidize this. It's being added to our bill, so it is exceedingly costly. Totally against it, all the way, Green New Deal.
Okay. Well, thank you for your perspective on that. Molly, I'd also like to go to Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Nick, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yep.
So I'm a big fan of the possibilities that nuclear generation presents, but, you know, it seems like across the country there's these different storage facilities that are being proposed, but a lot of negative pushback from the communities that they want to put them in. So, you know, what's the solution to that? Just education, or, you know, are we going to have to start sending this nuclear waste to other countries to store?
Well, that's a great question, and thank you for that, Nick. So, Michael Schellenberger, it strikes me that that's a fair question for you. You know, you're saying, look, we have to – and look, let me also say, you rightly note Greg Yatsko is making an effort as part of his business to look at certain kinds of renewable energy sources. And you have said, I think, on your website that you don't accept any money from nuclear or other industries, right? Excuse me, or their stalking horses. And that's true also for the Breakthrough Institute, right? Neither of those
Correct.
Take money in that way. So you don't have a financial interest there. But if you're promoting a pro-nuclear future as a way of dealing with the vital question of carbon emissions – what do you do about this waste, which is not just going to live for years, but for not just for centuries, but for many, many millennia, for hundreds, you know, tens
yeah,
or hundreds
I mean,
of thousands of years?
This is the most shocking thing about nuclear. So the waste from nuclear power production is the only waste from any way of making electricity that is safely contained. It has never harmed anybody. We're talking about just the metallic fuel rods. After they get used, they get cooled in water for a year and a half or so. Then they're just stored on site. All of it. So as an environmentalist, you know, I worry about the gigantic islands of plastic waste in the ocean. I worry about the 4 million deaths a year from the carbon waste in the atmosphere, the pollution in the atmosphere. Nuclear waste, it all can fit on a single football field stacked 50 feet high. It's literally, as an environmentalist, I go, that's actually what you want from any kind of waste. You want it to be contained on site and the production site rather than going into the natural environment. Contrast it to solar panel waste. People sometimes don't think there would be waste. There's actually 200 to 300 times more waste per unit of energy produced by solar panels at the end of their 20 to 25 year lifetime. Most of it will go to poor countries. They'll be broken apart. And the toxic heavy elements in solar panels, cadmium, chromium, lead, they never decline in toxicity, and they're not safely contained. So, I mean, this is not really a difficult question. Nuclear waste is the best kind of waste from energy production, hands down, just by the fact that it's contained, never harms anybody, whereas every other kind of waste has negative environmental and human consequences.
All right. Well, I want to take a call quickly before our hour ends from Jefferson City, Missouri. Molly, please, what are your thoughts on this?
Hi. Yeah, I'm an environmental and energy scientist, and since the inception of nuclear power going back 50 years, the United States has yet found a place to safely store spent nuclear fuel rods. But if you check with the Union of Concerned Scientists, a small, tiny fraction of the 100 nuclear power plants that are aging now and that have to keep these nuclear fuel rods submerged in water, or the amount, there's just a tiny fraction of the waste from any one of them escaping would render, entire states uninhabitable, as is the case around the, for 1,000 square miles around the Chernobyl nuclear power plant.
Sounds like you'd prefer our resources be focused elsewhere for getting our energy needs. Greg Yatsko, I'm going to give you the last word. We don't have a ton of time, just maybe 45 seconds to a minute. Where would you turn to replace all this this energy being produced for electricity?
Well, I mean, the answers are clear. Right now, the cheapest sources of electricity that you can use are wind, solar, and natural gas. So, the question is, as we go forward, as you're building out new capacity, the cheapest thing you can do is wind. Next comes gas, and then solar comes somewhere in there. And so what I think you really have to do is you have to fix that issue with gas, is you have to probably do things into the marketplace that ensure that gas is subsidized or penalized, if you will, in a way that makes sure that those carbon-free technologies will kind of get in under their limit.
And that's going to have to be our last word. You've been listening to Gregory Yatsko. He's the former chairman of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission and author of the new book, Confessions of a Rogue Nuclear Regulator. Thanks so much, Greg.
Thank you.
We've also been hearing from longtime environmental activist Michael Schellenberger, president of Environmental Progress, a group that supports the expansion and embrace of nuclear power. Thanks, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
This conversation will be going on in boardrooms and in Congress and elsewhere, but also on our website. You can get our podcast there. You can continue the conversation. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook, On Point Radio. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.